Thank you for joining us. For 9 years, I ran an alcohol and drug abuse program for the Roman Catholic Diocese of Phoenix. I did a lot of public speaking. And in that time, I was amazed at how much the public knew about alcoholism. But more important, I was amazed at how much they didn't know. They knew a lot of the surface things. But really, what goes on inside of the alcoholic or the addicted person or what happens to the family members was really a mystery, and I believe still is, to the average person in our culture today. So what I'd like to do in the time that we have together, about an hour, would be, let's make it real. We'll make it real in this way. Let's suppose that in 50 minutes, I'm going to drop dead. And I know that I'm going to die 50 minutes from now. And I want to tell you everything I know about alcoholism that'll help you understand it and help you in terms of recovery if that applies to you. The kinds of things that the general public don't know about. So I'd like to title this particular presentation, Alcoholism Renamed. That name, alcoholism, has been around for a long, long time. Most of us wouldn't like to have that applied to ourselves. But it's a big improvement over what went before. We were called all kinds of things. The most popular one in this country was drunkard. There's some other real nice ones like moral degenerate, no good, rotten, so-and-so. And a lot of alcoholics have been called all kinds of those terrible names. They've even been called some terrible names professionally, dipsomaniacs. And this morning what I'm going to do, because some of the people in our audience this morning are recovering alcoholics, and I'm not going to tell you which one. In fact, as a little aside, let me share this with you. At one time, a friend of mine who makes displays for large conventions was going to construct one for me that we could move around from school to school and church to church. And basically what it was going to be was a pamphlet rack. It was going to be the kind of a thing where people would come to get literature to find out about alcoholism and about recovery. And my friend told me you always need some kind of a hook or some kind of a central focus on something like that. So the way we designed it, the display never got built, but the way we designed it was this way. In the middle of all of this, there was going to be a curtain with a large, fancy velvet drawstring on it with a big knot and tassel on the end. And over that curtain were the words, "The typical American alcoholic." And our hope was that when no one was around, curiosity would get the best of some people and they'd see that tassel and they'd come and pull that. And when they did, the curtains would part and they'd be looking into a mirror. Because that's exactly what the typical American alcoholic looks like. You can't tell from the outside. And because you can't tell from the outside, today I want to talk about the inside, what happens inside. If you catch on to what's going on inside of an alcoholic, then you have half of a chance of understanding what alcoholism really is. It's not just uncontrollable drinking. And the way I like to explain this doesn't involve going to school or learning any special language. It deals with some things that you already know. Let me show you what I mean. If we were to draw a chart here, and we'll call this a feeling chart, we have extremes. Up here would be high feelings, positive feelings, the kind of feelings you'd like to have, the kind of feelings you would like to sustain in your life. And down here, low feelings, negative feelings, the kind of feelings you'd like to avoid. At any given time, you and I and everyone else is somewhere on that chart. Now let's look at social drinking first. Not alcoholism, but social drinking. I'll tell you in a moment why we want to look at social drinking first. Let's suppose our social drinker, having kind of a normal day, has two or three drinks. What happens is that there's a mood swing in a positive direction. Now as the alcohol, or as the social drinker detoxifies, as the alcohol gets out of their system, they return on a feeling level just about where they began. That's social drinking, and that can start anywhere. You could have a bad day and still feel better for a while, then have a bad day. You could have a wonderful day, have a few drinks, feel super wonderful. And there's a real range between here and here, and that's in the life of every human being. When you're up here, this is wonderful. That's when you're in love. Remember? That's when you were in love, and the person you were in love with loved you. God exists. He's doing what you want Him to do. I mean, no matter what happens, things get better. You open the window, you hear birds singing. You haven't heard birds in centuries. Well, maybe you're not that old, but you haven't heard birds in a long time. And not only are the birds singing and that pleases you, you suddenly discover they're singing your song. And you listen a little harder and they're singing your song in four-part harmony. I mean, no matter what happens, it gets better. A technical word that you may be familiar with is euphoria. And a lot of people have felt very euphoric, way up on this end of the chart. And it happens normally in everyone's life. You can make it happen chemically in some people's life. I had an addict tell me one time about the euphoria in his life. He said, you know, when I'm loaded, you could come in my room and tell me my bed's on fire, and I'd say, why didn't I think of that? You know, no matter what happens, it's going to get better. But there's the other part of this chart, too, down here. This low end of things, and a lot of us have been there at different times. There's a feeling right about here, if you put it in words, would sound something like this. I think I'm going to commit suicide as soon as I feel better. You know, it's just bleh. And no matter what happens, it gets a little more bleh. You know what I'm talking about. Now let's talk about social drinking for a while. As that social drinker has his three or four drinks and experiences that mood swing, something happens. What happens within that social drinker as that mood swing takes place, he changes how he feels. She changes how she feels. And I know that's kindergarten material, and I know you already know it, but I want to point it out, and I want to put some things together that maybe you haven't thought of together before. And when you see things that way, it'll make a lot more sense to you, I think. When you drink alcohol, you change how you feel. No one has ever drank alcohol and felt the same way that they drank or that they felt before they drank it. When you drink alcohol, you change how you feel. That's why people drink alcohol. It's not any more complicated than that. If it didn't change how you felt, you'd probably be drinking water. It's a lot cheaper. They don't tax it. You don't have to run down to the corner to buy it. You drink alcohol because you change how you feel. And for those of you who find this a little too complicated or technical, I can describe this whole thing, changing how you feel, in one word. And if you've ever had a drink of alcohol, you'll know what I mean. Here's the one word. Whee! Okay? We've established that. When you drink alcohol, you change how you feel. Now, let me point something else about that feeling chart. When you're living a normal life, there are all kinds of things that happen to you. My mother passed away about a year ago. And when she passed away, it came as a great shock to my sister and myself and the rest of us. We weren't ready for that. Mom didn't die when we thought she was going to. And besides that, we'd scheduled a family reunion that was going to take place about 2 weeks after that. And my mother had perfect health. And I was upset. And when those things happen in your life, you get upset too. Let me tell you something else about my life that you may not know. Just a month ago, or a little more than that, I guess, a couple of months ago, someone came up with a free trip to the Holy Land, to Israel, for me. I got to go for nothing, and it was wonderful. Why is he talking about his mother dying and the Holy Land? I'm talking about my mom dying, and I'm talking about the Holy Land because of this chart. When you drink alcohol, you change how you feel in a positive direction. And when I talked about my mom dying, most of the audience here, as I watched them move down here with me, and they noticed it became sadder. And when I talked about a free trip to Israel, they moved up here. And they got happy with me, and their faces brightened up. What that proves is that you're alive. We have a live audience here today. And it was kind of a sneaky little test that I gave them just to see if they were awake. But what that means is that you're in touch with what's really going on. Later we'll make a good case for alcoholics, for addicted people, not being in touch. So what you learn is that you change how you feel in a positive direction. There are only two other things we're going to talk about today that have to do with what you learn as a social drinker. Let me point this out. You learn those things the best possible way you can learn anything. You learn it emotionally. I was telling some friends earlier that I looked at my college transcripts not long ago, and I found out I got straight A's in a course in epistemology. That's good news and bad news. The good news is I got the A's, right? The bad news is I don't know anything about epistemology. I probably couldn't even define it today. It was just one of those courses that you take in college to make it through. What a waste that was. See what I just did with you? I whipped you around on that chart. He made A's. Hey, that's not too bad. He doesn't know any epistemology. What the heck is, you know, some kind of a real dunce. To be in touch with your feelings and move up and down in that kind of a way proves you're alive. And for some people, when they experience that transcendent feeling, changing how they feel in a positive direction, that comes with alcohol, it becomes extremely appealing. Because a lot of people, a lot of us, don't like the way that we feel, and we'd love to change that. So what happens is we drink a little more. And as a social drinker, you don't have to drink too much more to realize that it always works. So when you drink alcohol, you learn that you change how you feel in a positive direction and a way that always works. Now, for those of you that are here with me, is there anyone here who has ever taken any, let me have a volunteer. Anybody here drink alcohol or used to? Anybody, anywhere? Okay, how about the lady in the red right here? What'd you like to drink?
Wine.
Wine, okay, and your first name? Evie. Okay. Evie liked to drink wine. Did you ever take a bottle of wine back to the liquor store or wherever you bought it and said, hey, fella, I want my money back. This stuff doesn't work. Huh? No. You don't have to feel bad about that because no one else has ever done that either. Why? Because it always works. And you know that. And you know that. And I know that. It always works. Now listen to my words. We come to have great faith in that. We learn that when we drink alcohol, we change how we feel in a positive direction in a way that always works. And what I started to talk about earlier is this, that learning is in the best possible way. It's emotional learning. I wasn't very emotionally involved in my epistemology class. But I can remember a science class that I just loved. It was in high school. I remember the teacher. I remember some of the dresses she wore. I remember the textbook. I remember the chapter headings. I remember a lot of the classmates, where they sat. Why? Because I was emotionally involved in that class and I cared about it. The point I'm making here is when you were a social drinker, you were emotionally involved in learning these three things and the fourth thing that we'll put up here in a moment. You learn this mood swing, and every cell in your body learns that mood swing. That's the best kind of learning there is. Watch someone who's had too much to drink, whether they happen to be an alcoholic or not. If you have too much to drink, you get drunk all over. Have you noticed? You're not just intellectually drunk, your feet get drunk. You want to walk over here and your feet go this way somewhere. Your whole body follows. Watch someone who's had too much to drink try to get a key in a lock. That's really hard. You got to find the right key, and there are a lot of them here, you know. Something has taught you through experience that you sway a lot during this procedure. So you try to stable, you plant your feet, and finally you get the right key, there it is, and now you got to put it in the lock. Now that wouldn't be a hard job if you hadn't been drinking. But if you've been drinking and you're swaying, you have to steady yourself, hang on to the key, just get it lined up properly. You have to judge the speed of the door as it's coming by. You get everything lined up, and that's when you drop the keys. Now you got a brand new problem. You got to pick up the keys. That wouldn't be so bad, but you've been drinking. That's when you hit your head on the door. Oh, it's getting complicated now. You finally recover the keys. You find the right key. Here comes the door again. You drop them. And it goes on and on and on. That's real funny. It's humorous. And humor is part of life. It's also part of alcoholism. There are funny things about alcoholism. But if when that person gets that set of keys again and finds the one he's looking for and does get it in that door, and that door happens to be attached to a car, then he opens that door and gets in there and puts the key in the ignition and starts to drive, that's not funny at all. There's nothing funny about that. And what happens when you get close to alcoholics, or when you get close to an alcoholic situation, you just get whipped back and forth all the time on that feeling chart. And it's the alcoholism that's moving you up and down. You're really not in control of your own life. Let me make an aside about humor. Because humor is involved in recovery. It's a very healing kind of thing. I hope I don't get too theoretical, but one of the basis, the main basis for humor is that all humor is actually based on the fact that we make mistakes. God doesn't make mistakes, but you and I do. We slip on banana peels, and that's funny, because you'd think a human being would see that, but he doesn't. And when we slip, we laugh because we identify with it. Let me tell you a joke, and then you'll understand what I'm talking about. This one happens to be ethnic, but so are a lot of jokes. A lot of people say, oh, I shouldn't be telling an ethnic joke. A lot of people would say you shouldn't be talking about alcoholism either. That's going to raise the pain level. This happens to be a Polish joke. Two guys walking down the street. One of them says to the other, hey, I got this great Polish joke for you. And the other guy says, I don't want to hear it. He says, what's the matter? You're the only Polish person I've ever known in my whole life that liked to hear Polish jokes. He says, yeah, that's right. I really used to like to hear them. But the trouble with being Polish is you hear so many Polish jokes that you hear too many. And I don't want to hear anymore. That's why I'm not Polish anymore. And his friend looks at him and says, what do you mean you're not Polish anymore? He says, well, I changed my nationality. That way I don't have to listen to all those terrible jokes. He says, you can't change your nationality. He says, well, I did. Let me prove it to you. Follow me. So the guy walks in the store, goes up to the clerk, and says, buongiorno. I'd like to buy a little zita, some pasta. I'm going to have some sausage. I want to make ravioli, have my friends over for dinner. And he whispers to his friends, he says, I'm Italian. And the clerk overhears it, and he says, no, you're not, you're Polish. He says, what do you mean I'm Polish? I'm Italian. What's the matter, you don't like the accent? And the clerk says, fellow, the accent's terrific, but this is a hardware store. Now, you laughed because it was funny, and it's funny because you're Polish. You just didn't know it. Huh? We're all Polish in that way. Huh? Okay, now part of recovery that we'll talk about a little bit later has to do with this kind of humor. It has to do with facing the tragedy of putting the key in the door and starting the car and driving when you're in no shape to control a vehicle. It has to do with facing into those really difficult, terrible feelings inside yourself that you don't want to look at. What I'm really doing is making a case for the fact that alcoholism is a feeling disease. And you can't talk about it effectively, you can't get involved in recovery unless you're willing to deal with feelings. So, with what we've learned so far, we've discovered that when you drink alcohol, you change how you feel in a positive direction. You also learn that it always works. And there's one other thing that you learn as a social drinker. We're not talking about alcoholism yet. And you learn it very well because you're emotionally involved. Every cell in your body is learning that little mood swing. What you learn is control. If two drinks make me feel this good, four drinks make me feel twice as good. You learn to control that mood swing by the dosage. So here's what we now know. When you drink alcohol, you change how you feel in a positive direction, a way that always works, and you can control it. That's social drinking. Let me illustrate social drinking once again this way. What it involves is an ingestion of a certain amount of alcohol, a mood swing in a positive direction. On the way back, after you detoxify, you return just about on a feeling level where you began. That's social drinking. Now what we want to do is look at alcoholism, and we want to look at alcoholism from the viewpoint of feelings. And this is where it gets easy, because you have feelings. You know what it's like when someone gives you a free trip to Europe, overseas. You know what it's like when your mother dies. You know what it's like in here. And the mistake that so many people make when they look at alcoholism or when they look at alcoholics is to just look at the outside. And until you get inside, it doesn't make any sense. So let's go back to our board here. And this time we're going to look at an alcoholic, not a social drinker. The reason we started with a social drinker is simply because most alcoholics begin as social drinkers. So this individual, 95% plus, drinks socially for a period of time. So this learning is programmed into us. Here we have our alcoholic who was a social drinker, has his normal amount to drink. There's a mood swing in a positive direction, but on the way back, he or she overshoots. So what that means is that the pattern has changed. This is the social drinking pattern. Mood swing, positive direction, return where you began. Alcoholism looks like this. After a drinking episode is over with, the alcoholic feels worse than when he began. Now, I have a friend who has a great gift. His name's Wally, and a lot of people here know my friend Wally. And Wally can say in a sentence or two what people write books about. And I want to tell you what Wally says in just a moment. Let me make another point first. And this is hokey. I'm embarrassed about this. But people remember this. This is the social drinking pattern. This is the alcoholic pattern. Once this pattern establishes itself, you never get back to this one. And here's the hokey part. Let's suppose that this little marker that I have here is a cucumber. And I take this cucumber and I run it through a process and turn it into a pickle. That's where pickles come from. There isn't anybody today with our modern technology or by wishing or wanting or radiating or setting up an electrical charge or running it through a magnetic field or making it radioactive or whatever. There isn't anybody that I know of that can take a pickle and turn it into a cucumber. That's a one-way process. So is this. Most alcoholics begin as social drinkers, and then they become alcoholics. But there's no alcoholic that I know of who has ever, once this pattern has established itself, turned into a social drinker again. It's a one-way process. This is the pickle pattern, or pardon me, this is the cucumber pattern, this is the pickle pattern. Here's the hokey part. Some little cucumbers lead happy lives all their lives as little cucumbers. Some get pickled, okay? But once you're a pickle, you'll never be a cucumber again. I've given this talk hundreds of different times, and at a retreat at one time, as we were getting to know each other, it was a married couple's retreat. I asked people to break the ice and kind of get acquainted. I said, I want to go around the room. I want everybody to give us three things. Give us your first name, something you're interested in on this particular weekend, and also tell us something about yourself that we wouldn't know unless you told us. So this guy got up and says, my name's George, and on this weekend I hope I can learn how to relax, and I'll never be a cucumber again. And he sat down, and about 100 people looked at him like, I'm going to spend a weekend with this guy? You know, well, you've been listening to me too much. He'll never be a cucumber again. What he means is he'll never be able to drink socially again. That's the great American dream, that we're going to find a way to teach alcoholics how to drink without being alcoholics. We don't know how to do that. We don't know how to do that. About every 2 or 3 years, someone writes a paper, publishes a book that claims how to do that. And probably the biggest example of that was the RAND Corporation, a prestigious think tank group, usually works with the military. A few years ago, 10 or more, came out with the so-called RAND report. It's about this thick, but the bottom line was they discovered that certainly clinically diagnosed alcoholics through special education and training could be taught to drink socially again. That made headlines in some of the places around this country. Just a few short years later, they published a retraction of that statement. They said, our findings are inaccurate. Our success cases have either died alcoholic deaths or are now drinking uncontrollably. In the meantime, a lot of people read that report and started drinking again, not bothering to learn a training process, whether it worked or not. And a lot of people died. And I know two of them myself that tried that. Alcoholism is a killer. And it's been a mystery for people for centuries as to what it is and what to do about it. But you and I are alive at a time when we know what to do about it. So if you have a drinking problem, get to somebody who knows something about that and go to school and sit at their feet and learn. And if you have someone whose drinking bothers you, please don't talk to them about their drinking. Talk to somebody who knows something about that. Don't talk to them directly. But don't give up, because there are wonderful things that can be done today to help bring the person to understand that they have a problem and do something about it. The topic of this particular talk is alcoholism renamed. Now, I'm going to rename it here in a moment, and we're pretending because I'm happy with the word alcoholism. But a more accurate word for what is going on would be this. Call it denial. When you're headed in this direction, in your head, and when reality is actually headed in this direction, outside of your head, you're confused. And that happens this way. Look at this learning that this person has as a social drinker. He drinks alcoholically. He feels worse than when he did when he began drinking. What's he going to do when he feels bad? Well, he knows how to change how he feels in a positive direction, a way that always works. He's going to drink. But see where he starts with this new pattern? The worse he feels, the more he drinks. The more he drinks, the worse he feels. See what goes on? What is happening is that he thinks he's headed that way because of his drinking and old learning, when in actual fact he's headed this way. Now, you can't get it turned around much more than that. It's called confusion. The word I would like to use is denial. Alcoholism is characterized, in fact, the most presenting symptom of it is denial. My friend Wally talks about the pickle and cucumber pattern, the fact that it's irreversible this way. He says there isn't anything that can happen to an alcoholic. Listen to these words. There's nothing that can happen to an alcoholic. There isn't anything that an alcoholic can do that a drink won't make worse. Now that's wisdom. See, what's involved here is a lot of self-deception. I think I'm going that way. And it's as if I take two steps forward and three backward with that alcoholic pattern. But this last step is never ever connected with alcohol, not in the mind of the alcoholic. Because programmed into his mind is that old learning that says, when I drink alcohol, I change how I feel in a positive direction, a way that always works. Now let's look at those statements. Are they true? Not for the alcoholic. When he drinks alcohol, he changes how he feels. That's still true. In a positive direction, that's partially true. We'll just say it's a half-truth. Because initially, he still feels better. When he drinks alcohol, he changes how he feels. Yeah, it's in a positive direction, but when you see this pattern, the end result of that is it's in a negative direction. And it always works. You better believe it always works, but it always works going this way now. There isn't anything that can happen to you, that it isn't anything you can do that a drink won't make worse if you're an alcoholic. And control, that is lost at this point. He can't control its drinking, it's controlling him. So that by the time most alcoholics get to treatment or recovery or AA, they're living most of their life down here most of the time, chronically depressed. And what do chronically depressed people do? Chronically depressed people, alcoholics or anyone else, do one thing better than anything else. They build a wall around themselves. And they build a solid wall around themselves because they perceive the pain that's going on in their life as coming from outside. Surely if I hurt this much, if I'm down on this end of that chart or that feeling scale, if I'm in this much pain, I wouldn't be doing it to myself. Aha. If I hurt this much, an enemy hath done this. Let's see. Who would that be? It's always the person closest to you. So that's the real tragic of alcoholism, based on false information, a false premise, that I'm not doing this to myself. We blame all of that pain on someone else who doesn't deserve it. So now I am hurting, and I am also hurting someone else or other people. That's the tragedy of alcoholism. People look at alcoholics and they say, yeah, it'd be terrible to have the shakes. Well, some alcoholics don't shake outside, but they all shake inside. And unless you've had those inside shakes, you don't know what it's like. The inside shakes come from thinking you're going this way and winding up this way. You take two steps forward and three back, and that last step is always connected not with the alcohol, but with anything else. It is connected with having married the wrong person. It's connected with having to live in Arizona. It's connected with having Ronald Reagan as president or John Paul as the Pope, or you can blame it on God if you want. It's always blamed on someone. God doesn't cause alcoholism, but he does get involved in curing it if you're willing to do some simple things. What most people do when they find out there's a drinking problem or that there's alcoholism is they keep quiet, they don't tell anybody, and you know what they do? They pray a lot. Well, you know I'm a Catholic priest, a clergyman. I want to talk to you about how useless prayer is. If I were to get up in a hurry here, and there's a little step in front of me, and I trip over that step, and I fall down on the floor, and I break my leg, and you all gather around me and say, Gavin, you got a broken leg, but don't worry about a thing. Tell you what we're going to do. We're going to pray for you. Thanks. What I really wish you'd do is take me to a hospital and get my leg set. We know what to do about broken legs. Personally, I believe God can cure a broken leg. I also believe he doesn't do it very often. I think he can cure alcoholism spontaneously too, but I don't think he does that very often. We know what to do about broken legs. Today, you and I are alive at a time when we know what to do about alcoholism, so let's do that. Usually when I talk to the public about alcoholism, I start out this way, and I'll share it with you. If you love an alcoholic, care about an alcoholic, live with one, work with one, whatever you do to try to help that alcoholic will make the situation worse. That's one general principle. Another general principle is this. If you love an alcoholic, live with one, work with one, care about one, emotionally involved with one, you can help an alcoholic. And I believe firmly both of those statements. And now you're thinking, he's crazy. Well, maybe I'm not a great example of sanity, but I can reconcile those two things. If you live with an alcoholic, care about one, work with one, live with one, anything you do is going to make the situation worse, unless you know something about alcoholism. Anybody can help an alcoholic if you don't try to help yourself. Get help to help. Talk to somebody who knows something about it. Now let's get back to denial. Denial is slippery stuff because the person who's involved in denial doesn't know that he's denying or doesn't know that he's perceiving and seeing and experiencing things differently than the way that they really are. Let me give you an example of denial. I had a friend once, an acquaintance who had a drinking problem. He's an alcoholic, and he came to me and we were talking about his drinking problem. This is a man, if I mentioned his name to this group locally, they'd all know who I mean. He's a well-known businessman, and he has a reputation built on being an honest businessman. In fact, when his name comes up in conversation, people make speeches about him. They say, there's an honest businessman. There's a guy with a lot of integrity. We need more people like him. I'm talking to him about his drinking, and because I'm so convinced of his honesty and his sincerity, I started leaving some questions out. But one of them slipped out anyway, and thank God it did, because I knew something about him he didn't know that I knew. I said, you ever been in jail? He said, no. And I kept asking him more questions. And I get this sick feeling in the pit of my stomach. You see, because I knew he'd been in jail. So I asked him again. I said, did I ask you if you'd been in jail? I said, no. I've never been in jail. Ask me some more of your questions there. Let's keep going. So I did, and I kept feeling more upset and nervous. And then finally I said, hey, we can't play games. You know, twice now I've asked you if you'd ever been in jail. He says, that's right, I've never been in jail. I said, three times you tell me you've not been in jail. I know you were in jail. Do you know what he said? Oh, yeah, but that was a nice jail. Now, I haven't met anybody yet who can tell me what a nice jail is. But if you examine what went on in the life of this man, you can understand how he could sincerely say what he said and not be aware of lie or telling an untruth. He was arrested for something he did not do. He was innocent. At that time, it wasn't drinking related. The jailer in this little town had it all figured out. He knew he couldn't have done this, but they couldn't get a hold of the arresting officer. They couldn't find a judge, so he slept in jail overnight. But because the jailer knew he was innocent, he treated him different, let him use his transistor radio, ordered a pizza in for him. Everybody else had bologna sandwiches. So because it was so nice, and because it was in it, compared to the way jail usually is, and because he was innocent and got that special treatment, he could, in his own mind, tell me, I've never been in jail. When you sleep in a locked cell overnight that you can't get out of, that sounds to me like being in jail. I didn't ask him if he's innocent or not. You see how that works? That's the kind of thinking that's going on inside of the alcoholic all the time. Because the perception due to all that pain that the alcoholic is in is distorted. And you make decisions based on that distorted view of the way things are. So when people ask me, are alcoholics con artists or liars, I get nervous because I don't know how to answer that. And if I say yes, that's not true, because when you think of a con artist, you think of someone consciously trying to rip you off. And if I say no, that's not true either, because they're certainly saying things that aren't true. So I found a way to explain it, and this is how I do it. It seems to be acceptable to the alcoholics I know. I say alcoholics aren't liars anymore than anybody else, but they are highly adept at subtly adjusting the truth. See, you adjust a little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit here. By the time you get down here, this has nothing to do with anything that went on back here. That's the sadness of alcoholism. We are pain-filled when we are addicted people. And because of that, we don't see things the way they are, and we do a lot of blaming. Now, let me get back to that wall that is built around the alcoholic. Sometimes it's a very aggressive, pushive, don't bother me kind of a defensive thing. But it can be humor. It can be just ways of avoiding things that are pleasant and nice. It can even take on the guise of becoming more spiritual or religious or holy. But what it does is it keeps people at a distance. It isolates the person with the problem. And it compounds the problem and creates new ones because the pain that's going on in here is blamed on folks out there that are completely innocent of it. Let's go back to our board, denial. I want to say some things about denial, and what I'm going to do here is fill in some blanks. I'm going to put a word there, and I'm going to do that for each one of these letters. So, a lot of alcoholics have been called a lot of dirty names, denial. D-E-N-I-A-L. So I'm going to give you a word for each one. A lot of alcoholics have been called a lot of dirty names. Didn't seem to help them. I'm going to call the alcoholics present here today some dirty names, but it might help. You see, if you're an alcoholic, I don't have to know anything else about you. If you're an alcoholic, I know you're defensive. Why? Because you keep defending something that is indefensible. It's okay for me to drink without getting in trouble. If you're an alcoholic, I know you're emotional. Why are you emotional? One of the reasons you're emotional is because you keep abusing a mood-changing drug. Another reason why you're emotional is because you find out you can get that way, or you can get your way by being emotional. Many alcoholics don't say it this clearly, but in effect they're saying to the people around them, don't upset me, I'll have one of my moods. Okay? And I say, oh my God, he's going to have one of his moods, we'll do anything. See? Here's a person who's sick, who's dysfunctional, who doesn't see things accurately, and he's got control. So, if you're an alcoholic, I know you're defensive, emotional, negative. Why are you negative? You're negative because you keep abusing a mood-changing drug, which is a depressant. That's really smart. Alcoholic says, oh my God, I'm depressed. I know what I'll do. I'll drink a little depressant. That'll fix it. Really bright. If you're an alcoholic, and before I wrote something on the board here one day, someone said, circle that I. So I did that. I said, what's that all about? Why do you want me to circle this I? He says, because all alcoholics have eye trouble. The big I am. I'm the center of everything. There's a word for that, that if I were writing it out, I'd write immaturity. If you're an alcoholic, I know you're defensive, negative, or defensive, emotional, negative, immature. The last two are hard to see for some people. If you're an alcoholic, I know you're angry. Why are you angry? Because you're not getting your way. And sometimes when you're really angry, you don't appear to be very angry to other people. But really there's rage going on inside of every alcoholic because they've tried their best. They didn't really want to hurt the people they loved. And somehow, somewhere in their mind, they know that they have. And that is such a painful thought, they can't even think about it very long. Just long enough to run from it. But if you've thought about it long enough to run from it, you know about it. And that increases the pain. If you're an alcoholic, I know you're also very, very lonely, and that brings us to the last letter, because there isn't anyone else in that world with you. So let me run through those words again. If you're an alcoholic, I know you're defensive, emotional, negative, immature, angry, and lonely. And if for whatever reason you become very defensive, emotional, negative, immature, angry, or lonely after you've achieved sobriety, you also become very, very drunk, because that's the face of the enemy today, being too defensive, emotional, negative, immature, angry, and lonely. Alcoholism is characterized by denial. A few years ago, a study was done in the East, and this proves how observable it is. A group of grade school teachers were taught, they took a summer course on alcoholism, and they were taught to see the effects of denial in their school children. And legally, I'm not sure you could get away with this today, but what they did was this. They taught their classes at the beginning of the school year in September for 2 weeks. And after observing their children for 2 weeks, they gave administration a list of the children that they thought who were the children in their classes, who they thought had alcoholic parents, one or more. And then they sent social workers into the homes and did some surveys, and they found out that those school teachers were batting about 95%. That's a pretty good average. And the amazing thing is, those school teachers never directly saw the alcoholics or the parents. They just saw the effects in the children. That's how clearly you can recognize alcoholism and the effects of alcoholism today. But in our culture, we have cultural denial. We pretend not to see that, or we pretend to call it something else. And way down deep in our guts, most of us believe that every American has the right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and the ability to drink alcohol without getting in trouble. The people who founded our country didn't type that one up, but we all believe it. But it's not true. Alcoholics are not bad people trying to become good. They're sick people trying to become well. What do you do about it? The first thing you do about it is terminate the use of the chemical. If you can't do that by yourself, get some help. The second thing is you get to some people who know something about it, and listen to their wisdom and follow their advice. And the third thing is pray. It sounded a little while ago that I was throwing prayer out. I don't want to discount prayer at all. But there are some practical things we can do other than prayer that we need to do first. We know what to do about a broken leg today. Some of us know what to do about alcoholism. Do that first. Just don't try to do it by yourself. Well, alcoholism renamed. What's that all about? It's about a different viewpoint or a perspective looking at an alcoholic and realizing that if he or she is to ever recover, they have to not just terminate the use of chemical, which is really filed away in their brain because of their social drinking history with it, the same place we file away all other pleasurable things. It gets filed away with pretty girls, fast cars, whatever, ice cream, whatever it is that appeals to you in that category. And that's all the more reason why alcoholics should not use mood-changing drugs. Because other mood-changing drugs put to sleep that outside part of your brain, which is your defense mechanism. You drink enough or you use enough other chemicals to put that asleep, and then you go back to your drug of choice. It's a sad thing. It's kind of a professional form of denial. Well, as long as I've started that, let me go ahead and pick on physicians. A lot of physicians say when they see an alcoholic, they see a nervous person, they don't know what to do about nervous people. They prescribe a few tranquilizers. Do you see the denial in that? Here you have a person who's chemically addicted to a mood-changing drug and you're prescribing another mood-changing drug to fix it. But it's very deceptive. It looks like it works. Isn't that great? George hadn't had a drink in 2 months. He hadn't had to. He's stoned on Valium all day long. Huh? But when the next real crisis comes along in his life, he goes back to his drug of choice, alcohol. But now he brings a new friend with him, Valium or Librium or whatever else it happens to be. Okay, I've been hard on the physicians. Let me be hard on clergy. And the reason I want to talk about physicians and clergy is simply this. Most people with problems like this still today go initially to physicians and to clergy to seek help. I can't think of two worse places to go. You know, you can close your eyes, open a phone book, and point at a phone number, call that number, you're probably going to get better help than asking a physician or a clergyman. And the reason for that is our training and our background. Now, medical schools and seminaries are changing, but most of those doctors and most of those ministers and priests aren't out there in public yet. The clergyman will inevitably translate or transfer or convert the alcohol problem into one that he likes to work with. Even when a guy's looking for help, he may say something like this. Gee, I think I got a drinking problem, Father. Well, let's see. You still got a job? Oh, yeah, I got a job. You still married? Yeah. Well, then you can't be an alcoholic. Is the alcoholic relieved? You bet he's relieved. He's going to start going to church again, huh? He's going to take care of the Boy Scouts, set up for bingo, anything he can do to keep this authority figure on his side. But that clergyman is working out of ignorance because most alcoholics are married, most alcoholics are employed. Alcoholics live in your neighborhood. And they look like the people that you look like, that you look at in the mirror in the morning. That's how common and how close they are. The conversation would probably be continued something like this. Well, you say you're married. Tell me about the marriage. That isn't very, not doing to it. Tell you what, let's work on the marriage. We'll fix that up, make that better. Then you won't drink so much. Right?
Right.
Wrong. How sad. Because now the alcoholic is not only not getting help for his alcoholism, he has a great investment in keeping his marriage screwed up. Because if you keep it messed up and have problems there, you can keep on working on that problem. You don't have to look at the drinking problem. See how that works? That is so common. But just because it's common doesn't mean that it's understood or the person involved in that actually knows what is taking place. So we live in a wonderful age. We live at a time when alcoholics can recover, when they can begin to unravel the mystery of their own life and find out why they do the things that they do. Because alcoholics hurt a lot. They also die a lot. And one of the reasons they die a lot sooner than they need to, is because those of us around them stand back and we look at him and they say, can't he see what he's doing to himself? pretty soon it'll catch on. Uh-uh. Most alcoholics die before they catch on. So if you have someone in your life, a friend, acquaintance, a relative, coworker, someone you care about, whose drinking bothers you, go talk to somebody who knows something about that and pay attention to them. Then you make an unbeatable team. Because you have the empathy, you have the connection, you have the closeness. That other person has the knowledge, the information, and the skill. And when you stay together and work together, you're going to find some wonderful things beginning to happen. There's something else I need to point out to you, or I really want to, and that is simply this. If you're in that kind of a situation, if you're in the situation where someone close to you has a drinking problem, you're already to a point very similar to the alcoholic. See, the alcoholic's sick and needs help. And if you really care about one or spend much time around one, you're sick too and you need help. Because it's contagious. Let's suppose I'm an alcoholic and you and I spend a lot of time together. I can breathe on you all day long. You're not going to catch alcoholism. I don't know how you get it. But if you are close to me, you're going to suffer from alcoholism in two ways. One obvious, the other kind of hidden. The obvious way is you're going to see someone you care about and love going down the tubes and becoming more and more dysfunctional. The other way you suffer is there's part of alcoholism that is contagious. Guess what part? The denial. You start thinking the way the alcoholic thinks. And you say things like this, isn't that bad yet? I had a woman come to me. And she says, you just got to go help my husband. That was a nice slip. You got to go help my problem. You got to go help my husband. He has this terrible problem. And I said, what's the problem? And she whipped out 20 pages of single space description of his problem. I couldn't believe it. I'm reading through this thing. She's an executive, so that's how they make things important. She had chapter headings and everything. Anyhow, little index at the back. I looked at that, and she says, do you think he's an alcoholic? And I said, if any one of these pages is true, he's an alcoholic. She says, oh, thank God, you just got to go talk to him. I said, does he want to talk to me? She says, oh, God, no, you're the last person he wants to talk to. So I now know I'm not going to go talk to him, because I've tried that before and it didn't work. And when I told her that, she got upset. Now, when she came in that office, here's what she said. Father, it has never been this bad before. I am going to kill myself. And a little later in that talk, she pulled out two typewritten pages of optional suicide methods that she'd researched. She's real serious. And when she found out I wasn't going to talk to her husband unless he wanted to talk to me, she said, well, you've been very helpful. And I have a lot of girls that work for me, and some of them really have problems, and I'm going to tell them how good you are and send some of them to you. Now, stop right there, just time out. What's she want to do? She wants to escape. I'm not doing what she wants. She wants to leave. In leaving, she does a couple of things, which you probably noted already. She becomes very charming and tells me the things I want to hear, that I've helped her a lot. Now, I know I haven't helped her. And I know that I'm in big trouble, and so is she if I let her escape at that point. So I said, yeah, but what about your husband's problem and you being upset about it? She says, well, I've probably been exaggerating. You know, I feel so good after having talked to you, I should go home and count my blessings. Now, doesn't that sound nice? Sure sounds nice to a clergyman. You've helped me a lot, I'll go home and count my blessings. How wonderful, my daughter, God loves you. A lot of denial going on there. Well, I've been in those situations before, and God put the right words in my mouth, because she said, what I should do is go home and count my blessings. I jumped right in. I said, name one. You know what she said? This is a true story. She said, you know, last night, when he shot up the apartment, all of the bullet holes are out in the open, and I can go home and hang pictures over. Thank God he didn't shoot in a corner where I can't get a picture. See how sick that lady is? How dysfunctional? And she doesn't even know it. And I pointed that out to her. She was a bright lady. I said, I don't know whether your husband has a problem, because I haven't seen him yet, but I've seen you, and you got a big one. Let me prove it to you. And I played that back to her, and she saw it. I said, when you came in here, you said, it has never been this bad before. I'm going to kill myself. And now you say, I feel terrific. I think I'll go home and hang some pictures over bullet holes, like little wifey things like that. I said, lady, you need help. And she saw it, and she believed me. And she got the help. And she got help on a regular weekly basis for a couple of years in a support group that she found. And eventually her husband came around. Why? Because she didn't buy into his denial. She didn't call him names. She didn't yell and scream at him. But she didn't have to believe the crazy things that he said to try to explain his behavior. And she started to own her own life and to live that. And it's a wonderful story. The last time I checked with him, I think he's been sober and comfortable 7 or 8 years. It takes a while. Alcoholism isn't recognized all at once. It isn't fixed all at once. But if we're willing to come together and to strengthen each other, wonderful things happen. Don't try it by yourself, but know that there's good help around to deal with the denial that's in you, whether it's alcoholic denial or the denial of a family member or professional denial or cultural denial. There's spiritual denial too. I'll let you figure all those out yourself. Let me end this way. I had the privilege of attending the first world conference of Narcotics Anonymous, and it was a wonderful experience. It built and built and built, and at the end of that conference, someone had to have the final say, and a little 19-year-old girl did. They asked her to close the conference, and she didn't know if she was going to do that and didn't know what to say, and got up in front of the microphone and just cried and cried and cried and said, I don't know what to say, I don't know what to say, and then she said it. She said, you can't do it for me, but I can't do it by myself. And she sat down. And no one moved. We sat there in silence for 5 minutes. The impact of that profound statement hit us all. You can't do it for me, but I can't do it by myself. So if these words have touched you or helped you in any way to see the real hidden enemy inside, the one that lives in our feeling life, that creates new problems because it operates on outdated false information, I've got good news for you. Together we can do something about that, and I hope you have the courage to do that. Thank you.